You're listening to Split Reel, the Chicago Independent Radio Project show on popular culture and societal attitudes. I'm your host, Kevin Fulham, and I'll be examining how film, television, and other elements of mass media both shape and reflect how we think about the world. For more information or archive shows, visit kevinfulham.net. Listening to Split Reel for the Chicago Independent Radio Project, and my name is Kevin Fulham, and joining me today is Leonard Pierce, and Leonard was a guest many times on my show Under Surveillance that aired on WLUW. We've talked about slews of pop culture topics, everything from superheroes to politics to war films. He's also the author of a new book called If You Like the Sopranos, and it's basically a history of the crime film. The films that have both inspired The Sopranos, but then also films at which The Sopranos had a direct impact, and TV shows, and even video games later on. And welcome, Leonard.
Thank you very much, Kevin. It's great to be here.
I want to start with a great quote that you have from Samuel Delaney. It says, "The only important elements in any society are the artistic and the criminal, because they alone, by questioning the society's values, can force it to change." I never had really considered crime's impact on society and how we view crime and what constitutes crime. But why are artists, why have they been so fascinated with crime tales?
Well, criminals are people who, another point that I make in the book is that the reason that criminals are so fascinating to us and repulsive at the same time is because they're not like monsters or aliens or even like enemies in a war. They're not people who are quantifiably different from you. Anybody could be a criminal. The person who lives next door, your son, your brother, your mother, anybody could be a criminal. So they're an integral part of our society. They're not really outsiders in any profound way, in a way that can be immediately recognized. Anybody that you pass on the street can be a criminal. But they serve the same role as those other groups. They're menaces. They're threats to us. You know, they can harm us. They disrupt our society. They won't play by the rules, and that's what Delaney was getting at. There is that, you know, there are a lot of groups and subcultures and people in society that won't play by the rules. But the most prominent of them are criminals, because that's how they make their living, is by pushing back against the rules and restrictions of society. And they do it for profit, whereas artists, who also push back against the restrictions of society and the laws and rules that we live by, they do it for more artistic or personal reasons. But they're both doing the same thing. They're both questioning why we have these particular laws and why we have these particular restrictions and what might happen if we transgress them. And artists have, since time immemorial been fascinated with transgression, and criminals literally make their living by transgression. So I think that's the reason that artists are so attracted to them. And there's also the fact that, audiences and artists alike are fascinated by people who do things that the rest of us can't get away with, that they either have the boldness or the stupidity, to fight back against the rules that the rest of us obey. So they do things that the rest of us probably all think about but never would consider actually doing. And that's fascinating in itself.
So it's interesting, I think, starting with you talk about Hollywood. And obviously, the book discusses, we're talking about crime films. And Hollywood itself is somewhat of an outlaw enterprise, because you have all these filmmakers that were escaping Edison and Edison's patents and his control.
Well, it's really not that way today. I mean, obviously Hollywood has become the establishment, but it's been so long that people forget that Hollywood was once quite literally a frontier town. It was a little community on the edge of Los Angeles, which at the time was not a big city, and it was all the way across the country from where the big growth was. At the time, all the big cities were on the East Coast or in the Midwest. And there were a number of reasons that Hollywood attracted filmmakers in the early days of Hollywood. And one of them was, the lighting conditions, because it got light much later in the day there. So, they could film at times that they normally could not. There was also the terrain, you know, there's a lot of various climates around there. You could film desert scenes, you could film forest scenes or whatever. But the primary reason is because it was very far away from where people lived. And a lot of these filmmakers were using Edison's equipment. And at the time, Edison and the French company, I forget the name of the company, but he and this company basically controlled the patents to all of the movie cameras because it was a very recent invention. And, you know, not a lot of companies were making them. And so it was very difficult to, you basically couldn't get this equipment except through them. And they charged outrageous amounts of money for it. You know, Edison was quite a profiteer. And so a lot of these people would get hold of these this camera equipment, and they didn't want to pay the rates. You know, they were these exorbitant rates that Edison was charging. So they went west because Edison didn't have a lot of people out there. He didn't have many people in his employ to keep track of the equipment. And so they would film during the day, and in the evening, a lot of them would literally hide the equipment under their beds or in bank safes or closets or whatever, because Edison was sending out private detectives and Pinkertons and, you know, people that he had hired to track down these directors and filmmakers and seize their equipment. So in a way, the whole industry was based on a criminal enterprise, because they were using this equipment in a way they were not legally allowed to do. And it was also a very lawless town at the time. There were a lot of murders and a lot of robberies at the time. Most people got around by horseback in the early days of Hollywood, and it was really something straight out of a Western. So in the early days of Hollywood, these people could definitely relate to the criminal mindset, because a lot of them were, operating on the fringes of the law to begin with.
So take us through the century of crime, or what you call the century of crime in your book. You know, what were the key landmarks, the key points in terms of cinema?
In terms of cinema, I mean, sociologically, I call it the century of crime, because it's a time when different cultural and social conditions, economic conditions, came together to make crime a much more profitable and widespread thing than it had ever been. It was the century that really saw the massive expansion and growth of organized crime, as opposed to just local, small-time crime. And that was reflected in cinema. So in the early days of cinema, you had a lot of Westerns and, you know, a lot of movies built around Wild West gangs, because those were still active in the, you know, very early part of the 20th century. And you had a lot of movies that were about train robberies, which were very common at the time. You know, people were still getting around almost exclusively by train. And your audiences were still kind of ruralized, so you had a lot of stories about small-time hoodlums and, you know, bank robbers and things like that. And then the major development that led to not only the birth of big-time organized crime, but about movies about them, was Prohibition. With Prohibition, you saw the banning of alcohol, and then you saw these organized crime groups just step in to fill that gap, you know, because people still wanted alcohol. And they became wealthy beyond imagining. You know, they just made vast amounts of money and got huge amounts of power by providing alcohol to a country that desperately wanted it and couldn't get it. They say that the first person in America to make $1 million in a single year, it wasn't one of the big robber barons like Carnegie or Henry Ford. It was Al Capone. It was the first man to make $1 million in a single year through the bootleg trade. And as a result of that, you started seeing people, you know, becoming fascinated with these criminals who were suddenly so big and so powerful and exerting so much control. So in the late 20s and early 30s, you started seeing movies, what are now called the gangster epics of the period, Scarface and I Am a Fugitive from a Chain Gang, just a number of really high-profile movies. Little Caesar was another one of them, that were about these bootleggers and these, you know, organized criminals. And that's when America's fascination with organized crime took off, at almost exactly the same time that organized crime itself took off.
Well,
and with that, Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Let me pause right there, and let me ask you: what's the reason that the Italians were the ones to really, the mafia, became synonymous with organized crime in America?
Well, there are a lot of reasons for that. It's not that organized crime was missing in other countries. There was definitely organized crime in Great Britain. There was organized crime in France and Italy. And, every country had some degree of organized crime. But it had thrived particularly in Italy and in southern Italy in particular because Italy, unlike the rest of the big European powers, was very politically unstable. It had gone through a lot of periods of political chaos. They had been split into little micro countries and kingdoms for a much longer time. They didn't have a strong central government the way that France and Germany did. They didn't have a lot of modern technology and sort of a technocratic approach in the industrialized society the way that Great Britain did. And so as a result, they really didn't have a lot of strength in government or organized law enforcement, And so whenever there's a void in law enforcement and government, that's when criminals thrive the most because there isn't really anything to hold them in check. So in the early part of the 20th century, those conditions led to the Italian organized crime groups having a lot more power and influence than organized crime groups had in other countries. And that was also an extremely strong period of immigration to the United States by Italians. And so there was a huge amount of Italians coming to the United States, specifically to the East Coast, New York, to Boston, to Quebec in Canada, to Cleveland, to all the big East Coast cities. And a lot of them were, they were people who had been involved in organized crime in Italy. And they brought that with them. So when Prohibition happened, they were more organized than other big ethnic gangs. There were big Irish gangs in New York. There were Jewish criminals. There were groups of organized criminals who were local, Anglo-Saxons. And, there were, of course, there were all kinds of organized crime groups. But none of them had the organization and the power that the Italians had because they just didn't have the background. They just didn't have the opportunity to thrive the way they had in Italy. And so, as a result, when the time came for some group to step up and say, we're going to take over the bootlegging business, Italian organized crime was in a unique position to do that.
Very interesting. I mentioned to you in an email before this conversation that certainly they possess characteristics that set them apart from the rest of the European immigrants. They're Catholics for the most part. You have Irish Catholics, but for the most part, you've got Protestants coming from Europe. You've also got the fact that they look differently. A little bit more swarthier. The beginning of Godfather 2, there's this classic scene where there's a senator talking to Michael Corleone, the Al Pacino character, and he's telling him that he doesn't like his oily hair and the Italians, ruining society for decent people. And it didn't seem like that was any sort of barrier in terms of the mafia, taking control of organized crime.
Well, there was always competition against the mafia, and certainly, there were groups that opposed them on ethnic terms, there were groups who wanted a slice of their pie, but the most successful organizations figured out pretty quickly that they were running things, that the Italians were the powers to be reckoned with. So you saw a lot of the Jewish gangs join the mafia, and the Irish gangs as well. The ones who were smart saw what was coming. They saw that the Italian organized crime groups had really kind of put a lid on things. They controlled things pretty quickly. So a lot of your early mob wars, in fact, especially in Chicago, were between Irish organized crime and Italian organized crime, and the Irish generally came out on the losing side of that. And then later, which is a whole different topic, the Chicago mob was very much more ethnically diverse than the New York mob. The New York mob was much more traditional and almost exclusively reserved positions of leadership for Italians, whereas in Chicago, the Chicago mafia, or what they call the outfit, They let a lot of Irish, Polish, Russian, and other ethnic minorities into positions of authority. They weren't as traditional, but one advantage that the Italians had, and it was both an advantage and a hindrance, is that they did have the hindrance of being, you know, of course, they were Roman Catholic. They were swarthy looking. You know, they had very distinctive names. You could look at anyone's name and tell if he was Italian. You know, and they had that outsider status, you know, of being non-Anglo-Saxon immigrants. But they also had the advantage over, for instance, Jewish gangs or African-American gangs of, you know, there was not as much prejudice against them as there was against Jews. They're obviously what, you know, they could claim to be white, you know, which the black gangs could not do. You know, they weren't as hated as the blacks. So they were able to be a part of mainstream society while also being on the outside of it, which worked both to their advantage and to their benefit, or and to their hindrance. You know, they could sort of play it both ways. To the bigots, they were, you know, obviously they were not like the rest of us. You know, they were not like ordinary white people, but they also, you know, they could pass. They could move amongst mainstream society. They weren't. You know, they weren't as ghettoized as African Americans and Jewish Americans were at the time.
Okay, so let's get back to the century of crime, and now you've got to the Prohibition era. How does that progress from there?
Well, then, you know, of course, after Prohibition was repealed, that's where the Mafia showed its first really great strength. You know, of course, it was no trick to be able to make money off Prohibition, because you know, anybody who could sell liquor could make money. What was the triumph of the Mafia is that they survived the end of Prohibition, that they saw it coming, and they were able to maintain their money and their influence and their power, even though Prohibition went away. And one thing that helped them in that regard, which I talk about a good bit in the book, is that J. Edgar Hoover, who was the head of the FBI, he chose to focus on bank robbers and what he called public enemies, you know, high-profile gangs that were usually led by one individual rather than going after organized crime. In fact, for a long time, he denied that there was any such thing as organized crime. You know, then in World War II, nobody much thought about crime. You know, it was obviously still taking place, but people had other things to worry about during the Second World War. And when it ended, In the world of organized crime, you started seeing more attention being paid to the Mafia. It was getting harder and harder to ignore the control they had over organized crime. You also saw in a lot of places, because the world had become a smaller place, you know, there was a lot of places that Americans visited for the first time during World War II, and immigrants started coming from those countries. So you started to see the growth of Asian organized crime on the West Coast from China and Japan. You started to see organized criminals coming from other parts of the country. Europe began to have a huge amount of organized crime problems at that time because it was very fragmented by the war. A lot of the authorities and social organizations had fallen apart because of the destruction and the, you know, economic ruin that the war had visited on them. So you started to see a lot of organized crime in Germany. You started to see a lot of organized crime in Great Britain. In fact, often by Anglo-Italians, the Mafia got their hooks into Great Britain as easily as they had in America. You started to see a lot of French organized crime. And then that was reflected in the cinema with the rise in the 50s and 60s of what was called the French caper film, where he's saw the adventures of these sort of clever, daring groups of criminals who would pull off some big heist. And then in America at the time, there was the big gangster pictures of the 30s that led to the development of the Hays Code, what was called the Motion Picture Production Code, which restricted and censored a lot of things that you couldn't show them on screen anymore. So you couldn't see these brutal gun battles, and you couldn't show the villain as being heroic. You couldn't show a cop as being crooked. And, a lot of directors, a lot of them who had come over from Europe, in fact, to escape the war. So you had a lot of European influence on cinema at the time. And these guys wanted to sell crime movies, but they were sort of restricted in what they could do. So they started pushing back against that with what were called films noir. At the time, they were just called crime dramas, but the French later dubbed them film noir. And they were a combination of, you know, these kind of dark, cynical crime films that had a bleak outlook, you know, that was sort of influenced by the war and all the destruction that had taken place in it. And they were also very visually striking. They used a lot of pure black and white and stark shadows and grays and, you know, strange angles and weird construction in the sets and kind of impressionistic filmmaking that came from the fact that a lot of these directors were from the European tradition. And so that's what you had in the 40s and 50s. It was film noir in America and heist films in Europe.
Let me pause and talk a little bit about film noir. And you mentioned in the book that, you know, that's the golden age of film noir, and it came at a time when society was more socially conservative. How do you kind of, or, you know, rationalize the fact that here we have these very bleak films, these very dark films at that particular time, and yet the television was very sanitized?
Well, it's actually quite easy to explain. Film noir was not popular. It was. It's become popular, and it's become a very critically respected medium. But at the time, these were B pictures or C pictures. You know, they were movies that got stuck onto the, you know, studios would release their A picture, you know, the big movie with the big stars, and then it would have tacked onto it a B movie, you know, which was to be shown, you know, beforehand, or and then maybe a C movie if it was a triple feature, you know. And these were movies that were made on the cheap, you know. They didn't expect a lot of people to be in them, or to see them, rather. The stars were not the big, highly paid, you know, marquee stars. You know, they were, you know, some of them were by little independent studios, what were called the Poverty Row studios, that, you know, just barely made any money at all. And, you know, there were a few of them that got to be big hits, but most film noirs, especially even the classics that we think about today, they didn't make any money. They were not movies that respectable people went to see. You know, they were kind of the equivalent of grindhouse cinema in the 70s or exploitation movies. You know, they were for the disreputable crowd who liked seeing that sort of thing. And even though they became you know, many years later, they got a critical reevaluation, and nowadays people rightly think of them as artistic triumphs. The movies that they were on the bill with, the A pictures, those were just as conservative as television. You know, their heroes were very straightforward. Their villains were very cartoonishly villainous. They didn't have any of the moral ambiguity or the, you know, the sexual or ethical questioning that film noirs did. You know, film noir was, it was an artistic accomplishment that came out of an economic necessity. And, you know, those movies were just not, they were not meant for polite audiences. So, you know, we think of them today as being more respectable than they actually were.
So then when did those sorts of films, or at least films that presented villains that were morally ambiguous, when did they reach the A-list in terms of cinema?
That started in the 60s and 70s because, you know, of course, that was a time when society itself was becoming less. I don't know if the society was becoming less conservative, but there were segments of society, you know, the young kids coming up in the 60s, the hippies, you know, and then by the 70s, the hippies who were getting older and becoming part of mainstream society. You know, these were kids who questioned the traditional 40s and 50s, you know, Eisenhower values, you know, the good old Americanism. And that's one of the reasons that, you know, Bonnie and Clyde was such a gigantic success. I mean, it was meant to be one of those B pictures. You know, when it was funded, nobody expected it to make any money. You know, they actually even made a deal with Warren Beatty to give him a big percentage of the profits instead of a big paycheck, because they figured that would save them money, because they didn't expect the movie to make any cash. And when it turned out to be a huge success, he made millions of dollars off it. He got rich overnight. And it was released at the perfect time. In 1967, you know, that's when American audiences were, especially young kids, were, you know, they were a little tired of the traditional Westerns and crime movies where the good guy always wins and the bad guy's always unlikable and the story's always the predictable, you know, bad guy does something bad and the good guy hunts him down. And, you know, it sort of turned that sort of story on its end. And instead you have this story about a couple who in real life were actually pretty unlikable. You know, they were uneducated, they were murderous, cruel. You know, they saw themselves as rebels, but they were really just kind of creeps. You know, the real Bonnie and Clyde were terrible people. But they were presented in this very romanticized, Romeo and Juliet tragic story about two kids who just couldn't fit in. And, you know, the young audiences of the 60s just ate that up, and the movie became huge. And so by the 70s, you had a lot of questioning of the traditional values of society as well as the traditional values of cinema. And at that point, you had a lot of talented directors coming through the system who had been brought up in the traditional cinema experience, but they had the values of the younger generation of the time, and those became your so-called maverick directors, guys like Martin Scorsese and Francis Ford Coppola. These guys started releasing movies in the 70s where, like The Godfather and Mean Streets, where the gangsters were not the villains of the picture. They were the heroes, or at least they were the protagonists. You know, you would go through the whole movie hearing only the story of the gangsters, and they may have been portrayed as villainous, but theirs was the only perspective we ever saw. You know, we didn't get to. There was no moment at the end of the movie where the cops swept in and arrested everybody, and were shown to be heroic and upstanding. You know, they were telling a very different kind of story by that point.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and I'm joined here by Leonard Pierce, and we're talking about crime films. And Leonard is a pop culture critic. He is also the author of a new book called If You Like the Sopranos. It's part of an If You Like series. It's all about taking various landmarks in pop culture and sort of looking at both the inspirations behind them, but also the areas of... And in The Sopranos, case of television, film, and even video games, where they've had a direct impact, and talking about the history of crime films, going decade by decade. You mentioned Bonnie and Clyde a few moments ago, and I've not seen Bonnie and Clyde, but the first thing that came to mind when I read about your take on the film is Natural Born Killers, which came out a little bit more than 25 years later, early 90s. And with Woody Harrelson and Juliet Lewis. And it seemed like they shared a lot of similarities in the fact that you have this extremely dark film about essentially mass murderers. They go on this huge crime spree, and they can't fit in with society. They're in love with each other, but are very much, they seem like sociopaths. And then also you have a Robert Downey Jr. who is playing the role of television commentator, and you see how these two main characters, these two killers, sort of derive an identity from the media coverage that's given to them. What do you think about that similarity? And also, what do you think about the your thoughts on the film in general?
I'm not a huge fan of the film. I'm not a big fan of it. Not only because I think it delivered its message in a pretty over-the-top way, which I'm not I prefer my message films to be a little bit more subtle, and there's one thing you can't say about that movie is that it's subtle, but it's thematically almost identical. It's definitely a Bonnie and Clyde for the postmodern generation. The stories are almost exactly the same, the themes are almost exactly the same, and it in connection with my book, it's the script was worked on by Quentin Tarantino, who, became, I call him the first crime movie postmodernist. So it's definitely a proving ground for what he was going to go on to do, I think, a lot more successfully as a director. But, it's exactly the same themes. You have the young kids who perceive themselves as being rebel heroes, but, the rest of the world sees them as brutal killers. Even the media stuff, that's not only straight out of the movie Bonnie and Clyde, it's out of the real world of Bonnie and Clyde, because the real world Bonnie and Clyde, one of the things about them is that they were extremely media aware. Keep in mind, this was in the 1930s. Bonnie wrote these poems and left them at crime scenes because she knew the newspapers would find them and pick them up and print them. You know, there are these very famous photos of Bonnie and Clyde posing next to their car with their guns. You know, they took those pictures themselves, and they knew that the papers would pick them up, and they'd be seen as these stylish, romantic characters. And, you know, they also, Bonnie or Clyde and his brother practiced moves that they would use during robberies based on footage they had seen and descriptions that they had read of John Dillinger. You know, so these are people who were self-creating themselves in a particular media way. And yet they turn, you know, they also blamed the media. You know, Bonnie in her poems talked about how the newspapers made them into villains and exploited them for personal reasons. And, you know, that's exactly what, you know, the message is in Natural Born Killers, is that the media is both condemning this couple and, you know, profiting off of their depiction as monsters. So, you know, Natural Born Killers is reiterating themes that came straight out of Bonnie and Clyde the movie, which came straight out of Bonnie and Clyde the people. So it's really a continuum that's, you know, there's no denying it. It's something that goes on today. You know, even today you have, you know, gangs and gangster kids who pattern their behavior and their moves and even their crimes after stuff that they see on television. And so it's a vicious cycle. And, you know, Natural Born Killers was just reiterating, you know, it was pointing out, you know, the continuing relevance of that cycle that's been going on for, you know, 100 years now.
Well, you mentioned that the real Bonnie and Clyde were, you know, were creeps. They were definitely portrayed in a much more positive light than they were.
They were murderers. Yeah, they were fairly brutal murderers. And, you know, they definitely had an image of themselves that was a lot more noble than the things they were actually doing. Yeah.
Well, I think that's also true in a lot of the later crime films, where the criminals are the protagonists. And it even, I mean, show like The Sopranos. I mean, you could see yourself like having a beer with Polly or hanging out with Tony, and these guys don't seem like terrible guys. What do you think about the way that crime and criminals have been romanticized?
That's been going on since there has been crime and violence. You know, that there has always been a tendency to think, you know, well, because a lot of people, you know, as we talked about before, a lot of criminals are legitimately pushing back against things in society that a lot of people don't like. People generally don't like the police. People like the law. They like that it exists, but they tend to take it for granted. You know, and nobody likes to be hassled by the cops. There are a lot of laws that we wish didn't exist. There's also the fact that these are guys who go out and do tough guy things that a lot of us only dream about doing. And, you know, there's a certain raw appeal to that. You know, there's a lot of people who, even if they would never do it themselves, they fantasize about going out there and finding everybody who's ever done them wrong and just, you know, wiping them out, you know, just having them killed like a mafia godfather does. And, you know, that's something that's just it's an essential element of crime, and it's always going to be. And sometimes this can be handled with kid gloves and sometimes it can't. I think there are certain criminals who genuinely were fighting back against, you know, illegitimate laws and illegitimate societal pressure. But for the most part, criminals are self-serving people. They're not in the game because they're trying to rebel against anything. They're in the game because they want to make a lot of money and they don't want to have to work for it. You know, they want to get fast money on the cheap, and they don't care what they do or who they hurt to get it. And David Chase is the guy who created The Sopranos is extremely attuned to that idea, and almost to the degree that he comes off as a bit too moralistic at times. But generally, he balances that pretty well. It's very clear throughout the entire run of The Sopranos that he thinks Tony Soprano is an awful person, but he doesn't beat you over the head with it. He just puts the evidence out there and says, well, just look at what he's doing instead of listening to what he's saying, and you'll find out what I think of him. And, you know, of course, Chase was always frustrated by the fact that fans wanted more of the, you know, the mafia action, you know, the murders and the crimes and the chases, instead of the psychological insight and the family drama and stuff. And, of course, that's what he wanted to portray. He wanted to show through the family drama and the psychology and everything that Tony was a self-deluding, miserable person who, you know, just kept falling back into the same patterns. And what the audience wanted was more shootouts. So that was one of the big contradictions of the series.
A couple of great points there. First of all, I wasn't a huge fan of a Dr. Melfi character, but I think she serves as a mirror, I guess, to Tony's behavior. And I think there's this one classic scene later on in the show where he's repeatedly trying to get her to go out with him and go on vacation and go off on a trip together. And she tells him flat out why she won't do it. And it's basically because he's an evil guy and he uses violence and he doesn't think much of other people. And Tony can't handle that. And you also see when Carmela, his wife, sees a psychologist, she goes to, I believe it's the Jewish psychologist who tells her that, you know, that she's living off of blood money.
He's far more moralistic than Melfi. He's the guy who just comes out and says, look, you're an evil person, your husband is an evil person, and you have to stop doing what you're doing and leave him forever, and that's all there is to it. There's no dancing around it the way there is with Dr. Melfi. It's an interesting contradiction, and I mean, like I said, it's one that David Chase was, he had to live with it and often was very frustrated by it. You know, he often expressed how frustrating he found it that the fans always wanted more killing and more mafia action. And, you know, he was trying to sort of criticize them for wanting that, you know, saying that's not what the show is about. And, you know, but on the other hand, you have to have something to bring people in. And, you know, people, you know, outside of a few, you know, artistically inclined critics, people don't like, you know, they don't like talky pictures. They don't like thoughtful, you know, psychological insight pictures. They like, you know, they like shoot 'em ups. They like the action. And it's not always necessarily true that that's what people gravitate towards, you know, especially with crime films. But I think you have to have that in there, you know, or else people are going to get pretty, you know, the majority of audiences are going to get pretty bored with it. You know, even a movie like The Godfather, which I don't think, you know, there's anybody who would dispute its classic status as just, you know, one of the great Hollywood movies of all time. It's a talky picture, but there's a lot of violence in those movies. There's, you know, and it's very graphic as well. You know, you have the scene where, you know, you have the very exciting scene where Michael shoots the Turk and the policeman in the restaurant. I mean, that scene is super tense. You know, it's a very thrilling, almost Hitchcockian, you know, scene. And then you have the super bloody scene where Sonny gets shot up on the causeway. And, you know, of course, the final scene of the first Godfather movie where the Michael's godchild is being baptized, and he's at the same time he's having his assassins take out the heads of the five families. You know, those things come few and far between in the movie, but they're unforgettable. And, you know, if they weren't there, I don't think the movie would be the success that it is. So even Coppola, who was making a very different kind of mafia picture, he knew he was going to have to put that stuff in there for audiences to be drawn to it. Film noir, if you look at film noir today, a lot of audiences get frustrated with it because it doesn't have a lot of extreme violence. You know, there's always murders in it or some kind of violence, but it tends to come, you know, those movies are all about mood and style and tone. And, you know, audiences today who are very into action tend to get frustrated by them. And so, you know, it's a difficult balancing act because I think audiences are always going to, you know, they're always going to want that kind of violence and the sort of thing that we've come to associate with action movies instead of suspense or thriller movies. But, you know, I think a skillful filmmaker can always introduce elements of subtlety and of thought and, you know, of depth into a movie as long as they can artistically pull out the stuff that people really want to see, which is, you know, someone pulling out a gun and using it.
So thematically and artistically, what were the other unique factors of The Sopranos that led it to become such a landmark cultural creation?
Well, it was a movie, or it was a show that had very cinematic qualities, which was not a feature that you usually associated with television before that. You know, television was always sort of considered the bastard child of cinema. You know, like movies were for smart people and TV was for dummies. And, you know, of course there had been intelligent and sophisticated shows before The Sopranos, but it was made on HBO, which means that, number one, they had a very big budget. And so it looked a lot more expensive and professional in production. You know, it didn't look like a TV show. Even today, if you watch it on DVD, it looks very cinematic. You know, there's a lot of there's a lot of really professional film work being done there. You know, Chase had definite cinematic ambitions with it. Also, HBO, it being on pay cable instead of network TV or basic cable, it allowed them to curse, you know, and it allowed them to show nudity, and it allowed them to show very extreme violence, and that set it apart from the rest of TV. HBO had been able to do that before, but, something about The Sopranos, they really used, they utilized it to maximum effect, and, you know, that was something that you associated with films, you know, that could show anything. It was an R-rated drama that was on TV. And it also had been written from the beginning, even though they don't show up quite as much in the first season, you can still see it. But this was a show that was meant to be carrying its stories over into multiple seasons. It was a show that was in the language that we've come to use, which came straight out of The Sopranos' success. It was a serial drama rather than an episodic drama. You know, previously most big TV shows, even crime TV shows, you know, you had a go into the week, you know, the cops would find some bad guy and maybe he would show up in the next season or so, you know, you'd have a recurring bad guy. But generally what happened from one episode to the next didn't make that much difference. The Sopranos was one of the first big TV shows of the modern era to become a huge success using what previously had been a soap opera model where you had to watch every episode to know what was going on, and where something that happened in episode 6 made a difference in what happened in episode 12. And it had that kind of serial style, and that encouraged people to keep watching and to keep returning. And, you know, it developed this extreme water cooler culture where people would get together the next day and talk about what had happened. And nowadays, that's very commonplace. You know, a lot of really critically and even popular successes, you know, Mad Men and, Breaking Bad and a lot of very successful shows use that format. You know, it's almost become the norm now. Even sitcoms are starting to use it. But at the time, you know, in the late 90s, there had been very few shows that successfully used that serial drama sort of storytelling. And so, when you combined it with a mafia story, which is something that, people always eat up mafia stories, and, you know, a lot of professional people behind the helm who are making it look very cinematic and, you know, with a terrific cast and the promise of nudity and bad language and violence, which always draws them in, you know, you just had a blueprint for a very successful show.
You briefly mentioned law enforcement officials before. With The Sopranos, it's interesting that you have sort of the corrupt, or it's implied that they have a lot of corrupt cops on the payroll, at least people further down in the food chain. But you also have a depiction of the FBI agents who are tracking The Sopranos and tracking the other organized crime figures. Some are trying to pin down Tony, but then you also have, there's an agent, Dwight Harris, who's also trying to help Tony as well. What are your thoughts on the evolution of how law enforcement has been portrayed?
When you started out, I mean, generally the police were always the good guys and, you know, they came to get the bad guys and, you know, they weren't as interesting because, you know, heroes are never as interesting as villains, right? You know, it's always the bad guy who's the interesting character. But, you know, at least they were the heroes. And in a few of the pre-code films, you got to show crooked cops. And once the Hays Code was instituted in 1934, that not only faded away, it literally was not allowed. You were not allowed to show a crooked cop. There were a few rare exceptions. They would make a movie with a crooked cop as long as he was very obviously brought to justice. But you're talking about a period of about 30 years or more where it was a rule of the industry that you could not get your movie released if a cop was shown to be crooked. And film noir was especially good at skirting that. They would either avoid showing the cops or show them as just the guy, you know, as sort of deus ex machina who would show up at the end and arrest the bad guy. You'd never seen him before, you know. Or in a movie like Laura, one a classic 1944 film noir, the cop, the detective was shown as, you know, he was the hero and he was the one who was going to get the bad guys, but he was a real creep. he was unpleasant. He was rude to everybody. You wouldn't want to hang out with him at all. You know, he just was a very unpleasant character. Film noirs were some of the few movies where you could actually show a corrupt cop, for instance, in the Asphalt Jungle, when the main character is a crooked cop, and another Sterling Hayden film noir, The Killing, there's another crooked cop involved. But, you know, even then, they had to be brought to justice at the end of the film. And then in the 70s, or the 60s, the late 60s especially, and then especially in the 1970s, really strong in the 1970s, you started to see a switch in that in both directions. You started to see more crooked cops. You know, you had a movie like Serpico, where Al Pacino played basically the only honest cop in New York. You know, every other cop in the city is portrayed as some degree of crooked. And then you also started to get movies like Dirty Harry, where the cops were not portrayed as crooked, they were portrayed as ineffectual. You know, and only Dirty Harry, who wouldn't play by the rules, you know, who basically acted like a gangster himself, he was the hero because he was the one who would really go out there and get the bad guys when all the other cops were too wimpy to do it. You know, they were too, you know, they were tied up in red tape and they had to be politically correct and they couldn't go after the, you know, because the criminals had all the rights and the victims didn't have any. So you had the Charles Bronson and Clint Eastwood type cops who were, you know, essentially vigilantes. And then, of course, in the 80s, that became the norm. You know, you had millions of movies of the renegade cop who played by his own rules, you know, in movies like Cobra, you know, where Sylvester Stallone plays a cop who's, you know, basically a death squad.
It seems like the criminals in those sorts of films were very cartoonish. They were very one-dimensional. It was clear, black and white. Mm-hmm. You had the serial killers, for instance, you know, the psychopaths and whatnot, or just, in the case of all those Death Wish movies, you just had sort of the cartoonish gang members. Mm-hmm. But it also seems that those characters are direct descendants of the heroes of Westerns. I mean, I don't know if you agree with that or not, in terms of sort of the frontier justice element.
Yeah, well, they're faceless, you know, in movies like that. You know, in Westerns, it's the Indians, and war movies, the Japanese, and in 80s crime movies, it's the punks. You know, they don't have any identity. They're just, you know, they're just villains. They're just people who are there to be put in the way of the hero's bullets, you know. And, that's a real reversal of film noir in particular, where everybody has a personality. You know, even the worst guys, you know, even the darkest villains have some kind of, you know, motivation or personality or character. You know, they're not just put there for somebody to shoot. there's a lot more development to their character. But partly because of The Sopranos, you know, which took an interesting approach to it, you know, because it was telling the story of the villain rather than the hero, it took a more nuanced approach to showing police. You know, you had, for example, the regular police force, you almost never see them. You know, I mean, Tony commits crimes in broad daylight and doesn't even worry about the cops. You know, he's confident enough in his ability to avoid being arrested. And then occasionally you'll see a story, like there's an episode where he gets pulled over by a cop played by Charles Dutton and, you know, tries to get him. You know, the cop turns out to be a little too honest and won't take Tony's bribe. So Tony uses his political connections to get him pulled off the force and then later feels guilty about it because he's actually so surprised at finding an honest man in the police force that, you know, he feels bad at having gotten rid of him. And then the FBI is also a difficult case. And, you know, it's a lot more ambiguous than it seems in The Sopranos because, as you say, at times they help Tony because they're more concerned with terrorism than organized crime. They consider terrorists a bigger threat than mafiosi. And so they'll give Tony a break if he cuts them some information about terrorists.
Even at the very end of the show, they help him in his war against Phil Leotardo because they see Phil's family as being more violent and more disruptive to society than Tony's.
Yeah, and that's a very common thread that's started to emerge in a lot of storytelling about modern crime is that, you know, the police make decisions and law enforcement makes decisions that are on a very questionable moral calculus, you know. I was just watching Sons of Anarchy before you called for an article I'm working on, and they really play up that, you know, that situation where the ATF agent, Leslie Stahl, she's quite willing to lie to put her witnesses in a bad situation, you know, and you see that in The Sopranos, too. Generally, the FBI is shown as pretty upstanding. They're not corruptible. You know, they genuinely want to put away these organized crime bad guys. But, for instance, you know, the way that they treat Christopher's girlfriend is disgraceful. You know, they essentially just blackmail her into becoming an informant, and, you know, they destroy her life. You know, they intentionally put, you know, say, look, if you don't cooperate with us, we're going to leak the information that you were talking to us, and it'll get you killed. The real law enforcement does that sort of thing all the time. It's a tactic, but it's an awfully brutal one. And so I think the tendency nowadays is to show police as being neither especially corrupted nor especially pure, but just engaged in a battle against an enemy that you really can't fight in a straightforward way. And that leads to, you know, a lot more moral ambiguity than we had seen in the past.
You mentioned Christopher's girlfriend, Adriana. She turns into an FBI informant by, as you said, basically blackmail. It's kind of a good segue into the role of women in Sopranos. And you mentioned in the book that the women in The Sopranos are powerless. And from Adriana to Carmela, she has very little sway, I think, in terms of Tony's criminal behavior, whether it's his philandering. How do you kind of contrast, well, you contrast in the book the powerlessness of the Sopranos women and the what you call the ruthless femme fatales of the noir films that you saw 50 years earlier. What are your thoughts on that disconnect?
You know, for one thing, I want to clarify. I think that Carmela and most of the mob women that we meet, the mob wives that we meet in The Sopranos, they're not helpless. They're intentionally helpless. They're blind. You know, they have chosen a particular lifestyle, and in order to sustain that lifestyle, they have to delude themselves about what their husbands do for a living. And they pretend to be helpless, but they're really not. They just don't want to do what is necessary to get themselves out of their situation. You know, I mean, it's made very clear early in the series that Carmela, you know, when Father Phil talks to her, and also when, you know, the FBI talk to her, that she doesn't, you know, she doesn't like what Tony does. She doesn't like what it does to their family. But the reason she stays is because she doesn't have to work and she has an extremely extravagant lifestyle. If she wants something, she gets it. And that's more important to her than what the mob lifestyle does to her family and to her, you know, self-respect and everything like that. And, you know, I mean, she's obviously shown as being an intelligent and capable woman. She's a lot smarter than Tony is. You know, but she likes what Tony does for her. She likes being rich. She likes being, you know, idle. She likes being waited on. She's, you know, there's a number of scenes where she lords it over her, you know, who she perceives as her social inferiors. She's not afraid to intimidate people when, you know, she thinks that'll be necessary. You know, as when she got Meadow, and as she tried to get Meadow into Princeton, you know, by, you know, kind of subtly threatening a woman, her neighbor's sister. You know, the women in film noir, you know, certainly we have developed a lot of feminist ideas since then, but we now live in kind of a post-feminist generation where you have these extremely contentious arguments about what feminism means, you know, and of course, you know, there's two extremes of this. You know, there are the people who say that feminism has succeeded because there are a lot of wealthy and powerful women in the world, and there are those who say that, you know, feminism has not succeeded because you know, there are only a few wealthy and powerful women. There's, you know, there's the ability for some women to get very powerful, but most women are still trapped in, you know, very restrictive social roles. There's also sexual feminism, you know, like, is it the feminism of being able to do whatever you want with your body, you know, and ownership of your body? Does that equate to, you know, for instance, the whole slut walk controversy, where some people said that was not feminist at all because it was women deliberately appealing to a very sexist conception of women's bodies, and others said that it was extremely feminist because it was women doing what they wanted, you know, and that's the whole essence of feminism to them. And so what you're seeing in Carmela is not a pre-feminist model, it's a very post-feminist model. The women in film noir, the femme fatale, they lived at a time where life was extremely restrictive for women. You know, this was the 40s and 50s, you know, the Eisenhower era, where women were not expected to work outside the home. You know, they really couldn't make any kind of life for themselves without a man. You know, they couldn't be sexually aggressive. And the femme fatales were the opposite of that. You know, they were like, I'm going to get my way no matter what I have to do to get it. And so they did it by being very physically aggressive, you know, by plotting violent crimes. They were very sexually aggressive, you know, often they were, you know, in a reversal of what's often the case in film. You know, they were the sexual aggressors and the men were kind of sexually timid or, you know, intimidated. They used their bodies. They were smart. They were cunning. And, yeah, the femme fatale is kind of a sexist representation insofar as they're evil women. But it's also sort of a progressive representation in that at least they're women with their own minds. You know, they're women who are acting on their own desires and are doing what they want to do no matter what it costs them. Of course, in The Godfather, we're introduced to Kay, who she has her own weaknesses, but she's shown to be sort of a, you know, a traditional feminist model in that she makes her own decisions. She doesn't really trust Michael. She does her best to get away from him at first. You know, she does manage to eventually break away from him, even though it's in a very shocking way. You know, she doesn't see herself as being able to get into this model of, you know, the mob wife who just docilely accepts whatever her husband does. And then by the time Goodfellas rolls around, you know, you have Henry Hill's wife, who is more of a Carmela Soprano type. She's a modern woman. She's smart. She's perceptive. She, you know, she has her own ideas, but she's very seduced by the easy money and the easy lifestyle of an organized crime wife. And she doesn't like the other wives. She talks about them as, you know, like they're all named Maria. They all have three kids. All they ever do is talk about their families and complain. And, you know, but also she hangs around with them because that's the price she has to pay for being, you know, a kept woman who gets all the money she wants without having to work, you know? And, so by the time The Sopranos rolls around, we've got, in Carmela Soprano, we have a woman who's in that situation in the post-feminist era. And, you know, you see a lot of that in Meadow too. You know, Meadow is a smart young woman. She's aware of her father's activities in organized crime, but she's torn between this knee-jerk reaction to defend her father. She always defends him to outsiders, you know, saying, you don't know anything about him, you don't know what it's like, and, you know, she uses some of the same justifications as Tony uses himself, but she can't stand the violence, she doesn't like the, you know, she doesn't like the self-deception, you know, she hates to see her mother, who she thinks, you know, she sees as a smart, independent woman in the role of a kept woman and, you know, just never exercising her own authority. So it's a very complex idea, and I don't really think things have gone backwards for that image of the woman so much as the femme fatale. You know, the femme fatale is a feminist figure in a pre-feminist era, you know, whereas Carmela Soprano is a pre-feminist figure in a post-feminist era.
Well, just listening to your depiction of the femme fatale, I immediately thought of Tony's sister Janice, who I think would probably fit more of that description, in that she's much more active than Carmela. She attaches herself to figures like early in the show, Richie Aprile, and then later on Ralph Cifaretto.
And then Bobby Bacala.
And then Bobby Bacala, yeah, exactly. And mm-hmm. I mean, certainly, you know, she's not a woman. She actively pursues these guys.
Yeah, she's aggressive. She's conniving. Yeah. You know, she still wants that money and she still wants that access to power and everything, but she's not quite as delusional as the rest of them about what she's doing.
You wouldn't say that she's smart, but she's very cunning.
Nobody gets anything over on her, you know.
Yeah.
She's one of the only people who can really get under Tony's skin, you know. I think tellingly, she's also one of the only people who was really aware of how awful Livia was. You know, she took care of Livia towards the end of her life, but that was just an excuse to get at her money in her house, you know. I think she was only one of the few people in the family who really was, you know, locked in how terrible a person Livia Soprano was.
You talked in your book about how criminals have often taken their cues from cultural icons in terms of behavior. You know, you had the tough guys of really of 20th century. They borrowed mannerisms from films like The Public Enemy. You see it in Sopranos all the time, where they're either quoting The Godfather, or they are
Scarface
is another big one, yeah. And well, a couple questions. The first question is, you never see them talk about or you'd ever hear them talk about Al Capone in a very reverential way. And, you know, you had the huge Untouchables film that came out in the late 80s with Robert De Niro playing Al Capone in very much, you know, sort of a very charismatic, you know, hammed up to the hilt sort of way. Do you think there's a reason that you don't see that?
Well, for one thing, Tony actually does watch Al Capone movies in a couple of episodes of The Sopranos, and he seems to approve of them. But I think for one thing, that's a pretty distant era for a lot of these guys. You know, even the older generation, like Uncle Junior, you know, he's too young to remember Al Capone. You know, Al Capone committed his crimes in the early 30s and late 20s. You know, that's their great-grandfather's era by this point. And they might kind of distantly respect him as an old-school gangster, but, you know, in general, they're like, who the hell is Al Capone? You know, so they're much more likely to idolize people of, you know, the Goodfellas generation, you know, the 70s, you know, going back to, you know, of course, Tony looks at his father, Johnny Boy Soprano, as a legend, when in reality he was just kind of a small-time hood. And those memories are from the late 50s and early 60s. Even The Godfather, which, you know, a lot of that takes place in the, you know, the 40s. It was made in the 70s, you know, so they think of it as a more contemporary situation. And of course, you know, they look back at those guys as the, you know, the real, you know, the guys like Capone and Johnny Torrio and all those guys as, you know, they were the legends. You know, it's hard to even relate to them because they're so, you know, they're almost like godheads. And I think they can more relate to the cultural figures of a more modern era. Tony's the only one who likes to watch old movies, although he does seem to enjoy them, you know.
You never see them reference Goodfellas, which I know there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of crossover between the two stories in terms of actors that are used and whatnot. You know, are you surprised at all by that?
Not really. I mean, as far as Goodfellas goes, that's the touchstone, you know, for... I mean, Chase has talked about that movie ad infinitum as being, you know, the central mythos of The Sopranos. And, I mean, he even took a bunch of really minor actors from that movie, you know, ones that if you blink, you won't even see them in the movie, and put them in The Sopranos. It's interesting because... their behavior is so mediated, and Chase talked about this in an interview. He said, in his experience with actual mafia figures, they were themselves, like real-world mafia figures, not the ones he made up for The Sopranos, but like the real Goodfellas, were obsessed with The Godfather. They quoted it all the time. You know, it was their foundational document. And, you know, just like Bonnie and Clyde were aping, you know, John Dillinger and Machine Gun Kelly, you know, these guys are aping gangsters who never even existed, you know, they're loosely based on real people, but, you know, they're patterning their real crimes and their real personas after fictional characters. And it's really fascinating to me that, you know, the two feed off of each other, and not in a simplistic, well, if you watch gangster films, you're going to turn into a gangster way, but, you know, in a way that they just, they're like kids almost, you know, like saying, well, I'm going to pretend to be, you know, a cowboy and you pretend to be an Indian. You know, these guys are, you know, they're real professional criminals and they're taking their personas and their behavior from movies. And I just think that's it's both amusing and kind of terrifying.
Yeah. And, you know, you wonder if the remnants of organized crime now are doing it today with The Sopranos. You know,
mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Taking their cues from Tony and Polly. You know, a very interesting point you brought up in the book is how your gangster rap culture, well, we talked before about this, you know, gangster rap culture has idolized mafia characters in films, you know, Scarface, Snoop Dogg put out an album called The Dog Father, with the same cover of the, you know, the marionette strings and whatnot. And,
there have been like 20 rap albums that use that font.
Okay.
Whoever designed that Godfather font has made a lot of money off of gangster rappers.
What I think it's interesting, you know, you talked about in your book how obviously with the mafia, you know, it's a very racist culture. They didn't think very highly of black people at all. And yet, in terms of the gangster rap, they've sort of adopted, you know, those elements, or at least they idolized that culture. And I mean, maybe you can speak to this, but it seems that that's something that's looked up to much more than actual black gangsters. You know, gangsters that you saw in Menace to Society or even Ghost Dog, The Way of Samurai, which you talk about in detail in the book with Forrest Whitaker.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of reasons for that. I mean, first of all, a lot of you know, what they call hood pictures, you know, these early 90s, you know, urban crime movies like, you know, Juice and Boys in the Hood and Menace to Society and all those, they tend to be cautionary tales. And, you know, they're usually made by people who don't want to glorify the, you know, the gangster lifestyle. You know, they usually show these guys as fairly desperate during their lives. You know, they're not living in mansions. They're not driving super expensive cars. They don't have that Corleone money, as somebody puts it in The Sopranos, you know. And they come to a very quick end. You know, their villains all die at the end of the film, and, you know, having learned nothing, you know, their gangster lifestyle has led them only to destruction. You know, so I think they're not necessarily looking at those movies. They probably like them, you know, but I think that they aren't really taking lessons from them, because, you know, all the people in those movies fail. Whereas, you know, look at The Godfather, you know, Michael Corleone, he gets rid of all his father's enemies. He takes over the family and he becomes incredibly rich and incredibly powerful. And yeah, it costs him his soul, but who cares about that, right? You know, when you can have all that money and power, you know. And it's the same thing with De Palma's Scarface. I mean, sure, he dies a bloody death and, you know, his end is not a glorious one. But along the way, you know, he just has mountains of cocaine and all those flashy guns and, say, you know, those pure white suits and the giant red mansion in Miami. And, you know, it's just, you know, who would not want that lifestyle, even if it meant you had to go down, you know, in a pile of blood and coke, you know, at the end of it. You know, so I think that's one reason, is that they're looking for guys who won, you know, or at least won in the short term. They gamed the system, you know, they took out everybody who tried to attack them. You know, they succeeded when everybody thought they would fail. Now, one figure that does get name-checked a lot, one black gangster who does get name-checked a lot in rap music, is Frank Lucas. You know, and they just recently made a movie about him, American Gangster. And I think that's because he kind of succeeded in the long term. He gained the system. You know, he became one of the country's first and most successful black drug overlords. And he didn't die. he went to prison, but he lived through it all. And so you see, I mean, even Jay-Z made an entire album about, you know, Frank Lucas, the American Gangster album. And so he's one of those rare sort of criminal success stories. And, you know, of course they name check The Wire a lot, because it's, you know, not so much because anybody in it was a big success, but because it was perceived as having a lot more street cred than, you know, a lot of these big Hollywood movies that kind of make the whole gangster lifestyle a little cartoonish. You know, The Wire is perceived as being more real, you know, more street, and, you know, it has more credibility. So you see that get name checked a lot. But yeah, I mean, I think the reason why is because, especially the older generation of gangster rappers, you know, guys who are now in their 30s and 40s, you know, they grew up watching The Godfather and Goodfellas and Scarface. They didn't grow up watching, you know, Juiced and Boys in the Hood. And so that's what they gravitate towards. Plus, those guys were big and successful. And, you know, occasionally they'll name check some of the other flashy 70s stuff, like, you know, Shaft, of course, gets name checked a lot, even though he was a cop. You know, Shaft and, you know, a lot of the black exploitation movies, Superfly. There is a million rap albums that use Superfly as samples. And, you know, Superfly has even become slang for kind of a real cool guy, you know. And so it's, you know, there are certain black gangsters that get name checked. I think it's just the ones that are patterned more after the white gangster movies, where the good guy or the bad guy is allowed to win at the end, or at least, you know, up until the end.
You know, you mentioned Shaft as a kind of first a question I want to get to about datedness of films. You know, we can. I don't know if you disagree about this. You know, Shaft is one of the films that you mentioned in your book. That I think it came out originally, I want to say 71. I think if you compare that with The Godfather that came out right around that same period of time, you know, Shaft is, to me at least, seems much more of a dated film. And of course, Godfather is a period piece, which is an important factor. But what makes certain crime films more dated than others?
That's a tough question. And, you know, when you sent me the synopsis, I had to do a lot of thinking about that. I think that generally, and this is kind of a lame answer to fall back on, but I think that really it has to do with the quality of the film. If the film is really well made, it's not going to seem that dated, even if it's very old and deals with subjects that aren't very relevant anymore. Whereas if a film is badly made, it's much more likely to seem hokey and dated. You know, I think, like, for example, a lot of the gangster classics, you know, like Scarface and Public Enemy and, you know, movies like that from the early 30s, they're not that relevant anymore. I mean, you know, they were made at an era where filmmaking technology was a lot cruder than it is now. And also, you know, they deal with prohibition, which, you know, there's probably a lot of kids today who don't even know what prohibition was, you know, so they're not going to relate to the bootlegging aspects of the thing. You know, but they're good movies, you know, they're well written, they're well acted, they're well directed, you know, they're well done, and so people are going to watch them and think that they're good. And, you know, the difference between The Godfather and Shaft is simply that Shaft isn't that great of a movie, you know. I mean, it's The Godfather, they spent millions and millions of dollars on that movie, and they used a cast of, you know, like a once-in-a-lifetime cast, whereas Shaft was made for next to nothing, and a lot of the cast are just total amateurs, you know, they're just not very good actors. And so, you know, it has less to do with any particular aspect of the story than it has to do with the fact that Shaft was just made on the cheap. You know, if the guys who made Shaft had the kind of money that the guys who made The Godfather was, we'd still be talking about it today in the same terms. You know, it would have been, they would have hired better actors, they would have hired a better screenwriter, you know, they would have more money to spend on sets and, you know, design and costumes and everything. You know, I think there are some exceptions, like, for instance, a lot of the really early gangster pictures from the 20s, they're going to seem hokey to anybody today, no matter how well-made they are, because, you know, they were very sentimental. And a lot of really early movies, you know, they're based on theatrical, you know, they're adaptations of plays. And the acting is very stagey, and, you know, it's very theatrical, and all the, you know, all the dialogue is very over the top and ridiculous, and it's, you know, the stories are very melodramatic and overblown. And, you know, that tradition is gone. There is just no theatricality in film anymore. Film acting has become its own thing. It's much more naturalistic. And so that stuff seems hokey no matter how well it's done, just because it comes from a tradition that doesn't much exist anymore. But, you know, you look at something like, you know, I'll give you a perfect example. In film noir, you know, everybody remembers film noir because it had this really snappy dialogue. You know, it's very kind of very clever, you know, like very sophisticated imagery, and everybody talked in a rapid clip in this very clever manner. Nobody really talks like that. It's completely artificial. And yet we look at it as very naturalistic because we're used to that sort of thing. You know, it's a cinematic tradition, you know, it's a part of it's a cultural phenomenon. And so you can revive it today in a movie like Brick. I don't know if you're familiar with Brick.
Brick is actually one of my favorite movies.
Yeah, I mean, Brick's that whole thing, you know, these lowlifes speaking in this gaudy criminal patter, and transferred it to a modern high school, like a California suburban high school in the mid-2000s. And it sounded perfectly natural. Like, you can't, there's no school in the world where the students talk like that. But because it's such an established cinematic tradition, and because Rian Johnson did it so well, we don't even think twice about it. We accept it perfectly. It's the same thing with, you know, I mean, you look at a movie like, you know, The Big Sleep or A Double Indemnity, you know, even in the 1940s, nobody talked like that. You know, you couldn't go anywhere and hear people actually engage in that kind of racetracky kind of dialogue. That it's completely artificial, but, you know, it just asks the audience to accept that these are these kind of people who talk like that, and, you know, the audience went along with it. So it's it just shows you that it's not really the what's occurring, it's how it's presented, you know, that makes the big difference.
I'm talking to Leonard Pierce, who's a pop culture critic, and he's also the author of a new book called If You Like the Sopranos. It's part of an If You Like Pop Culture series, which in this case, talking about the Sopranos and all of the inspirations in terms of crime film that preceded it in the 20th century, but then also the television that's come since and the crime films that have come since. But what do you think in terms of television today is the series that's, that seems like the closest descendant of Sopranos in terms of style and theme?
You know, I almost hate to hand it to this show because it trumpeted its similarities to The Sopranos so loudly at the time that it seemed really phony to me. I was like, all right, we get what you're going for. Don't oversell it. But Sons of Anarchy has really become a very close inheritor of The Sopranos, not necessarily in terms of quality because, you know, the Sons of Anarchy is an on and off show. It can be excellent. But it can also be pretty plodding, you know. It doesn't have the kind of high-powered talent behind it that The Sopranos did. But it does the same job of mixing, you know, this sort of family storytelling and psychological storytelling with really gaudy, pulpy action and, you know, mob drama. And it's also very popular. It's one of the most popular shows on television. You know, it's I think it may be the highest-rated cable drama right now. So, like The Sopranos, it was not just a critical hit of success, but a popular one as well. And, you know, it does the same sort of thing in terms of theme. You know, you've got a character who's questioning his role in organized crime and, you know, whether or not he's losing his family because of the decision that he makes to defend his crime family. And, you know, it's got a decent cast. It pulls a lot of regulars from... you know, from shows like The Wire and a lot of the inheritors of The Sopranos. It's also got a very colorful supporting cast that it makes a lot of use out of. And it also, Kurt Sutter, the guy who created it and who was also a big force behind The Shield, he is also very skillful, as with David Chase, in incorporating music into the mise-en-scene of his show. You know, so music plays a big part of it. You know, he often does something The Sopranos really innovated, which was these end of season montages, kind of catching you up on where all the characters were, and some very compelling piece of music plays in the background. And so, while I don't think it's quite the same quality as of The Sopranos, it's definitely an heir to the show and a very close one.
You talked before earlier about the heist films, the caper films, the crime films that we, you know, you saw with the Rat Pack era. You also saw sort of the reinvention of those with the Ocean's 11 series, and it got me thinking about the nature of crime today, and certainly what's in the news today are primarily in America. You have white collar folks and bankers and people playing you know with mortgages for what you know and you have ordinary people getting hurt, but it doesn't seem like these are the kinds of crimes that are easily translatable to cinema, and certainly not in a style that would make the criminals very sympathetic, you know, in the tradition of sort of the organized crime films that we've seen. What do you think about how the nature of crime has changed today?
You know, one of the reasons that the mafia is such a threat, you know, the reason that you can never count them out is that they're very clever people, and, you know, they have shown themselves time and time again capable of adapting to new, you know, to new developments in society and in technology. You know, of course, the biggest and precedent of that was when Prohibition ended. They saw it coming. You know, the mafia saw it coming, and they said, "Well, we're going to, you know, move our money into some other form of crime. You know, we're going to figure out some place to make our money." Now that our biggest revenue source is gone, and they've continued doing that. And it's not that, you know, we didn't see a ton of that in The Sopranos, and certainly it's not as heavy as it used to be. You know, the mob has been superseded in a lot of ways by other organized criminal organizations, although it's less because they're not smart enough to adapt, and it's more because they're just getting hammered so much by RICO and, you know, other federal statutes. The FBI really goes after them in a strong way. You know, they're big targets. But they really have adapted in recent years. The mafia is involved in a lot of cyber crimes, a lot of computer crimes. You know, you saw in The Sopranos a little hint of this in the, I believe in the second season, where Christopher starts running a stock market fraud, Webistics, and that's based on real life. Some of the biggest money-making things that the mafia has been involved with since the 90s has been the stock market. There's a really interesting true crime book called Nothing But Money by Greg Smith, and it's about how the mafia got involved in Wall Street and, you know, just made enormous amounts of money by stock manipulation. You know, that was a way that they adapted to modern, you know, changing circumstances. They're involved in a lot of real estate scams. They're involved in a lot of stock market scams, cyber crimes. They're involved in a lot of financial, you know, like in terms of hiding money and laundering money. That's still a big thing for the mafia. And I think one of the reasons that you don't see, you know, in terms of actual banking scams, you know, the sort of thing that the Occupy Wall Street movement are talking about, is that, first of all, they don't have an element of violence to them, per se. You know, I mean, even the most financially motivated of mafia crimes, even their stock market stuff, it ultimately rests on them using physical violence. You know, they tell their stock guys, you push this particular stock or we'll beat your ass, you know. They have some kind of threat of violence or manipulation behind them. Whereas, you know, these big shot banks who engage in extremely risky stock speculation and, you know, gamble millions and billions of dollars on various, you know, extremely dubious investments, they're not doing it in a violent way, which, you know, automatically makes it less cinematic because, you know, nobody's going to get physically hurt by it. They're just going to get ruined. And also, that it's not illegal most of the time. You know, these are people who can afford to have the law rewritten so that, you know, what they do is not illegal. And so it's really not even a crime most of the time. That's why, you know, there's this crowning irony of the fact that, you know, thousands of Occupy Wall Street protesters have gone to jail, whereas, you know, of the people who created the current financial crisis with all kinds of extremely dangerous and legally dubious financial maneuverings, none of them have gone to jail because, you know, very few of them even committed crimes. And the ones who did, you know, they're generally protected by their wealth, and it's extremely hard to prove that they did anything wrong. So, you know, they're able to make money in very uncertain ways. You know, they're able to make money that just makes mafiosi look like pikers. But they're, you know, they're in a position where, you know, if they did it, it's not a crime. You know, that's the axiom of big business, right? If you're a business and you do it, you're not a criminal. But if you're a private individual and you do it, you are.
At the very end of the book, you talk about, which I think is very fascinating, video game culture. And it's certainly, in terms of the intricacies of the storylines and the graphical presentation, you know, it's something that has only emerged within the last decade or so. And you talk about the Grand Theft Auto games, the Grand Theft Auto series, as being landmarks in terms of depicting crime, but within some sort of larger narrative where you have, you know, you have Hollywood screenwriters working on these, and you have real actors lending their voices to these productions.
And they make Hollywood money too.
I think you said the last Grand Theft Auto made $500 million.
Oh, yeah. A successful video game today will easily outsell a very successful movie. Because the things that involve the audience the most are similar in both forms of storytelling in video games and in movies. What kind of movies do people like to see? They like to see crime movies. They like to see action movies. They like to see war movies. What kind of video games do people like to play? They like to play crime games. They like to play action games. They like to play war games. You know, the most successful genres of video games and the most successful genres of movies in the last 10 years have been almost identical. You know, superheroes, crime, war, and action. You know, that's where everybody's money goes. And, you know, the one exception being that nobody's quite figured out how to make a romantic comedy video game. But as technology gets more sophisticated for video games, you know, what made for the Grand Theft Auto games, you know, the explosion that they represented in the medium, is that programming got sophisticated enough and storage media got cheap enough that you could really expand what you could show in the game. You know, before there were technical limitations that kept you from doing this, but eventually it got to be where you could take your character and have him go any place and do anything. And you could have, you had space, you had memory space for tons and tons of cutscenes, which are the little animated movies that move the story along, you know. So they became much more like movies just because they were suddenly able to do that. You know, the technology was there for them to do that. And they started making enough money that they could hire Hollywood actors to do the voice acting, and they could hire real directors to direct the games. They could hire professional screenwriters to make the story more compelling. There was a game that just came out very recently that was written and directed by John Milius, who
Red Dawn.
You know, he's the guy behind Red Dawn and Conan and a bunch of other Hollywood movies. You know, so you know they're getting a real, you know, artistic talent to come in and do these things now. And you know, the technology is only going to get more sophisticated. They're going to, you know, there's a Godfather video game.
Yeah, I think there's a Sopranos video game too, isn't there?
Yeah, there is a Sopranos. It's not very good, but
yeah.
In the Godfather video game, they basically make you a character who isn't in the Godfather movie, but the whole game plays out like the Godfather movie with this new character inserted in it. And it's really kind of unsettling how easily they made that happen. You know, I mean, you can't even imagine that happening 10 years ago. But, you know, the games that we're going to have 10 years from now are going to be equally unfathomable. You know, there's going to be, you know, the goal is that basically the holy grail of video games has always been putting you in a movie. You know, it's that's been the ideal of video games for a long time, is we want to make them like a movie where you're in it. And it's getting closer and closer to that every day. And you start to see little subgenres emerge. Like, you know, you've got the, Grand Theft Auto 4, which is very much in the style of a kind of a grim 70s crime drama. And then you've got the Saints Row series, which is, the style of play is similar, but the genre is more like urban gangster type stuff. And then you've got, the Call of Duty series and the Modern Warfare series, which, you know, are equally immersive type war type stories, but they have their own little differences. And the goal of each one of them, you know, they get less and less constricted. You know, in other words, traditionally in a video game, you had to go to one particular place and do one particular thing, and then you go to another place and do another thing. And increasingly, you know, you have video games that are just very cinematic and, you know, very open-ended, and you can go where you want and do what you want to do, but you still keep the story moving along. And, you know, so you end up with movies like Bioshock, which came out a few years ago, which is just extremely cinematic. You know, it looks like it was designed to be a movie in the first place, but it wasn't. It was written specifically for video games, and, you know, that's the way it's going. You know, it's just, we're going to see, they're always going to be influenced by whatever the popular trends are in film and television, but they're going to look more and more like film and television themselves.
So Leonard, if you had to pick, give me one either film or television show that from the early half of the 20th century, from the second half of the 20th century, and then from the last decade or so that you mentioned in your book that you would recommend in terms of something that people might have overlooked but are incredibly entertaining depictions of, or incredibly entertaining crime films or stories.
Well, from the early era, I would recommend, and this may be relevant right now because there was just a remake of it, which was not quite as good as the original, is a 1948, I believe it came out, movie. It was made in Britain, called Brighton Rock. And a British film based on a great novel by the novelist Graham Greene. And it was about this small-time London gang that gets taken over by its youngest member, a teenager named Pinky Brown. And it has some similarities to The Sopranos in that it really deals with Catholic guilt. You know, Pinky is a bad Catholic. You know, he's devoutly believes in Catholicism, but the only thing he cares about is heaven, is hell. You know, and punishment and vengeance. You know, he doesn't believe in redemption or salvation. And he is this terrifyingly violent character, even though he's, I think he's only like 17 or 18. And it was made into a movie just, I think, a year after it was written. It's a little hard to find on video. You have to track it down. But it's based on the story about how Pinky, he murders a journalist who's found out about his operation. And this woman who lives in Brighton, which is a kind of a seaside amusement park type town in England, she met this journalist one day and kind of was taken with him, and she decides that his death was not accidental as it was ruled to be, and that she's going to find some way to avenge him. And it's about how these two characters clash, and it's just a really, really well-made British noir, some spectacular acting, and just a really amazing British setting, you know, just very, very good, and, you know, written very well, and, you know, for its period. For one a little later, I would maybe jump forward to the 60s and recommend a couple of French heist films. A lot of the French heist films were made by people who had grown up watching American film noir, and so they're very influenced by that, but they have their own unique, you know, continental flavor. And one I would really highly recommend is Bob Le Flambeur, which means Bob the Gambler. And that was it was an early film by Jean-Pierre Melville. It was one of the big names of French crime films. It's about this gambler who has just served a stint in prison and decided to go straight when he comes out. But he's approached by some members of his old gang who want to interest him in one last big score. You know, it's a classic heist film setup. And, you know, it's characteristic of a lot of the films of that period because it's very stylish. It's very sophisticated. It's got a lot of great dialogue and these unforgettable characters and settings, and it's beautifully filmed. Melville, he would do a lot of the background filming by attaching a camera to the front of a bicycle and riding it around the neighborhoods of Pigalle and Montmartre in Paris, and that's how he got a lot of this really amazing looking footage. And it's just a really great movie, very suspenseful and funny, and you know, very stylish. Contemporary stuff, I've really liked a lot of the European biographical crime films that have come out lately. One that I would recommend is Mesrine, which is a two-part movie based on the exploits of an infamous 70s Parisian gangster named Mesrine. But I would also highly recommend Carlos, which was also made as a miniseries for French television by Olivier Assayas. And it's a biography of the terrorist Carlos the Jackal, who currently is being retried in France for some old crimes. And so it's very relevant, you know, that this movie just came out. But it's a wonderfully done movie. It's, you know, it's a proof of what I think is going to be a lasting trend in crime films, which is that now that a lot of these older criminals are dying off and, you know, getting older, they're not able to sue anymore. So filmmakers are now free to tell their stories. And so I think we're going to see a lot more bio crime films, you know, biographies of infamous criminals.
That's very interesting. The families couldn't sue, I guess.
Well, you know, Bonnie and Clyde almost didn't get made because some of Bonnie's relatives threatened to sue. And so did the relatives of one of the cops who was portrayed in the film. And, you know, anytime there's a possibility of legal action against a film, it's hard to get it made because the studio doesn't want to risk getting sued. And the reason they were able to make the Carlos miniseries is because he finally got captured and convicted. And under French law, they're not allowed to sue you if they get convicted and are in prison. So you can make any movie that you want about them. And so people have been wanting to make a movie about Carlos the Jackal forever. And in fact, there are a couple of movies from the 70s when he was most active that have a character who's supposed to be him, but they don't name him specifically, you know, and that was because they didn't want to get sued. And now that he's in prison for life, he can't sue them anymore. And so they were able to finally go ahead with this production. But
yeah,
I think you're going to see that more and more, is that you're going to see biographies of people you didn't previously see biographies of.
My name is Kevin Fulop, and you've been listening to Split Reel, and my guest has been Leonard Pierce. And Leonard is not only a cultural critic, but he's also the author of a new book called If You Like the Sopranos, over 150 movies, TV shows, and other oddities that you will love. And Leonard, I think your website's still ludicid.com?
It's ludiclive.com.
Ludiclive.com. Okay, ludiclive.com. Thanks so much for joining me today, Leonard. It's been a pleasure.
Always a pleasure to be on your show, Kevin. Thanks a lot.